we need an open AI defense to watch all these sensors in a platform agnostic way and tell everyone where all the bad guys are. And if we do just that, we can both solve that problem, but also that's the first step to building the foundational AI for defense.
It's really surprising to look back at early days of DARPA through the Cold War and all of the innovation and technological breakthroughs that came out of it. I mean, a lot of the technology that we use the commercial side today, like GPS systems and many other things, came out of those research labs.
We need to build a tech stack for the American military 10 years from now, such that every drone, every warfighter, and every commander is all connected in the battlefield, and that you have a tech stack that goes from platforms like drones with sensors at the bottom, all the way up through networking and command and control enterprise software, all the way up to AI that can then turn sensor data into information in the heat of battle. Some people say it's like impossible to sell software in defense, or like you can't do it. That's not true. Like every prime sells billions of dollars of software to the DoD every year, just software.
Welcome to Autopilot, a podcast where we discuss the past, present, and future of AI and automation.
From Atlanta, Fulton County, passing.
It's one small step for man.
We explore how AI is creating and disrupting large industries in conversations with top founders, investors, and historians. I'm your host, Will Summerlin. Let's dive in. All right, John, thank you for joining us in the Autopilot podcast. So we're going to talk about the military, AI within the military, ISR, the Navy SEALs, a bunch of different topics. But before we jump into that, let's start with you. Can you share just like 1 minute of your background and how you came to found Modern?
Absolutely, Will. Great to be here. Good to see you. My background is pretty straightforward, but then I've done a lot of things. Grew up in rural Ohio. My parents were farmers. I went to study physics in school because I became very, romantically in love with the idea of the ivory tower and the secrets of the universe. And then when I decided physics academia is a bad path, I wanted to work on math and software. So I went out to the Bay Area to work on machine learning. First at Freenome, the ML genomics startup, building a blood-based cancer screen to replace colonoscopies, where I got to build a lot of their data infrastructure and work with a really awesome research team on a really hard ML problem. Then spent some time at Numerai, the quant hedge fund startup, also on data infrastructure and ML, just with different data. But when I left Numerai in summer 2020, didn't see a lot of startups whose mission I cared about, but I've been passionate about defense for a long time. And I decided I should do something about that, which brings me to Modern.
Two points. You're underselling Freenome a bit. You were one of the early engineers at Freenome, if I'm not mistaken. And Freenome's raised over $1 billion from like the best investors in the world. So
yeah,
that in and of itself is probably a career highlight for most people.
Yeah, I think I was employed like 12 or 13, and like the third engineer, that early Freenome team was just incredible. I learned so much from so many, both of the researchers and engineers there, and also a lot from the founders, Riley, Gabe, but also now the CEO, Mike. It's funny, I use what I learned about biotech, learning it from first principles, a lot more often than I ever expected in defense. I think they're highly analogous industries, where if you look back 10 years ago at biotech, it was only invested in by specialist investors. You had this like crazy double-barreled technical risk and political risk. The political risk was just the FDA rather than the Pentagon. And because of that, you had like disproportionate rates of dilution, disproportionate rates of acquisition, very small world. It was also like very CapEx and like network driven. And that all changed. We got a whole lot more generalist investors investing in biotech because we were able to envision a new type of biotech startup that was the biotech platform play rather than like the drug discovery play where you're betting on a process that can take 10 swings at bat at 10 drugs rather than like betting a company on one drug trial. And I see a lot of analogies to defense in there. There's a lot of things, of course, that make defense really, but I think finding that new business model to make defense more bang for its buck on CapEx, but also like educating an entire investor ecosystem on like how to invest in it is, I think, part of what's happening in defense right now.
It's super interesting. It's funny, in biotech, it seems like biotech is like the most pure form of venture capital where the outcomes historically have been pretty binary, right? And if it's binary, like the upside is huge. If it's, you know, if it's the wrong side of the coin, you lose. It's like sort of the purest form of venture capital, but then like software came along and just presented all these like easy layups for, you know, 50% IRR and people lean into that. It's funny on defense tech too, like now it's become super popular, right? Like everybody's doing defense tech in one flavor or another. You've got the whole El Segundo phenomenon. I'm curious, like 2020, that wasn't the case though. 2020 was still pretty early. What gave you the conviction to take a leap into the industry before it was obvious that there was going to be, you know, a lot of activity or a lot of capital flowing into it?
I need to start by giving credit to the people who were causing the breakthroughs that now has created the modern interest in defense and VC, which of course is 2020 was also when Palantir went public, or maybe early 2021. It was also when Anduril raised their first really giant round and people realized that they were winning. It was also when Rebellion got off the ground and Shield AI, I think, acquired Martin UAV and Heron Systems, which has like helped form the foundation of the company they are today. So a lot of the companies that we like, you know, the seed through B stage defense founders today owe the interest in the space to, they were already doing their thing. And part of what happened was I had heard about Anduril and I remember thinking, one, that's super cool. I actually didn't know you could start a defense startup. And when I heard about that, that probably was true. And two, that's also the best name for a company ever, like Flame of the West. Damn, that's so good. And then I became more interested in them in 2020. And I was looking around for what to do after Numerai. I was learning about Anduril and these companies that were breaking through. And I just decided to go one level deeper. Rather than just reading the news articles, go online and start reading RFPs and RFIs, you know, requests for proposals and requests for information from the Army and DoD program offices. And I started reading them and I realized I can read this. I can understand this. I also have known enough service members, but also been interested in defense topology long enough my entire life that I have ideas here. Any startup sort of starts with a moment of gut check where you say out loud you're going to do something for the first time. And when you say it out loud, either yourself or one of your friends will say, that sounds crazy. Or they'll tell you that's cool in a way you read between the lines and say they're telling you you're crazy. When I said that about, I think I want to submit for this Army RFI by myself and then later with two co-founders. And I think I want to submit some proposals for these Air Force R&D contracts. I knew it sounded crazy, but I wasn't deterred because the more I read about it, the cooler it seemed. And a lot of that came from just growing up with a lot of friends and family who served. A lot of that came up from being a technologist interested in defense for a long time. I was the type of college student who would read the F-35 Inspector General's report and just get really mad in my dorm room in college. Because I was like, this thing can't fly, can't fight. It's like 10 years behind schedule over budget. And so I always was doing that. And I always had this contrarian belief and excitement that like, the greatest technological breakthroughs came from national security. So I started reading the primary sources and getting smarter, started asking everyone who I knew, do you know anyone in defense? Like anyone, you know, to talk to them and learn from them. But it took some time to learn enough about the space to have a really strong contrarian vision on what I could build. I didn't come from a hardware background. I didn't think I was the right person to build like a drone or hardware company, but I knew AI and I had opinions about the right way to do AI. And when I looked at AI in defense, I was really shocked by what I saw, that everyone was talking about it. It's clear it's going to be the most important technology for national security over the next decade, maybe the next 100 years. And when I went another level deeper to see what the companies in defense were actually working on AI, it was a lot less than I expected. It was mostly like off-the-shelf models, even trying to solve problems from scratch with drone path planning, drone communication, sensor processing, swarm coordination in like either very old-fashioned ways or novel ways that weren't actually the Silicon Valley cutting edge, because some of the people building them didn't know what the Silicon Valley cutting edge was. And I came to this contrarian conclusion that the defining AI defense company hasn't been built yet, and that it wasn't going to be built by a hardware prime, a company that was building hardware, and it wasn't going to be built by a services prime, a company doing defense services. Because the hardware primes spend all their R&D money on hardware, and their incentive is to like vertically integrate the AI. And you know, services companies are services companies. They have limited margins. But there is this term, JADC2, Joint All Domain Command and Control. And we'll talk a little bit more about ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. These concepts are related and maybe in different situations interchangeable, like all duty acronyms. But basically the idea that we need to build a tech stack for the American military 10 years from now, such that every drone and every warfighter and every commander is all connected in the battlefield. And that you have a tech stack that goes from platforms like drones with sensors at the bottom, all the way up through networking and command and control enterprise software, all the way up to an AI that can then turn sensor data into information to, in the heat of battle, know where the bad guys are and then strike them. And a core part of that for AI is, how do we take raw sensor data in real time, show it to an AI, and have it tell you who, what, and where the bad guys are? Very simple, but insanely hard. And then how do you do that distributed across every single drone we're going to build? And what stood out to me about that problem was, if you talk to DoD users, they would tell you two things. One, we're not seeing AI solve this problem yet because the AIs aren't good enough. And two, when we do see it solve it, we are fragmenting our data, and the target tracks, the who, what, when, where of the bad guys that we get from an AI looking at the sensor data is then vertically integrated into like a hardware system or a services system. And it became pretty clear, okay, we need an open AI of defense to watch all these sensors in a platform agnostic way and tell everyone where all the bad guys are. And if we do just that, we can both solve that problem, but also that's the first step to building the foundational AI for defense. And that's where my conviction came from.
It's really surprising to look back at, you know, the days of ARPA and early days of DARPA through the Cold War and all of the innovation and technological breakthroughs that came out of it. It's really, really incredible. And I mean, a lot of the technology that we use the commercial side today, like GPS systems and many other things, came out of those research labs. But now if you look at AI specifically, like I know, I don't know, you do too, hundreds of AI researchers, right? Like the best in the world, and none of them work for the government. They all work for OpenAI or DeepMind or you guys or, you know, another commercial group. And it is really surprising. Like now it's just like people from IBM, like trying to tell the DoD what AI is, and like, not to hate on IBM, but like they're not attracting people away from OpenAI, right? Like you're not getting the best talent in the world. And it's really shocking and concerning. But maybe we could jump into like a specific problem set that you guys are focused on, just to break this down a little bit more. Talk us through ISR. And, you know, today, like, it seems like there are a lot of hardware platforms collecting data. How is that data processed? Is it like some level of AI, or is it just literally humans like looking at a screen and trying to decide whether something is a fishing boat or a Chinese naval vessel?
Yeah, absolutely. So if JADC2 is the big vision for how we tie all the sensors together with all the commanders and analysts, ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, is the more focused problem of how do we gather data on the world, looking for drug runners in Southcom and South America, looking for terrorists in CENTCOM, the Middle East, but also keeping an eye on the movements, activities, and aggression of the great power forces of Russia and China. ISR is the world of intelligence analysts in the DoD watching video feeds or looking at satellite images or studying like the radio signatures and detections of their reconnaissance assets. And quite often this is the Air Force's planes, but now of course it's also satellites, drones on the ocean, anything that's watching the world. And forever, this work has been entirely manual. There's a video feed, you have a drone, and some drones, like a Reaper, can fly 24 hours now. And you will have an intelligence analyst watching that video feed, writing down everything they see, looking for patterns in what they see, trying to recognize, like, the, say, the limp of the one terrorist leader they're keeping an eye on in some part of the world when he comes in and out of his compound. And doing all that thinking, all that tracking entirely manually. And many of these analysts are incredibly good at this. And of course, you know, a lot of it's an art as well as a science. But over the next decade, we are going to 10x the number of sensors that the DoD deploys, both to see more, but also to see faster and react faster. And when you do that, you can't 10x the number of soldiers, sailors, airmen, or Marines staring at these screens. And that is the transition that we are trying to go through today, bringing AI to this tech stack that goes from platform, sensor, like network, command and control software to AI, bringing that data from the sensor to the AI to start helping out an analyst on, here's all the people I saw, here's where they were going, did you miss this guy? And also just like highlighting things and finding things in data that often there's so much of, it's literally not analyzed today. Sometimes there's so much data collected, there's lots of analysts who have stories of like, oh yeah, that hard drive with like all of that imagery data or all that video data, like we couldn't get to it, no one told us it was important, we wiped it, we moved on. So a lot of that tech stack exists, but a lot of what we're building is how do we get the AI in there and more software to relieve the load?
So the vision in some ways, like you could say, is like a sort of like an all-seeing eye across Earth where you can identify and track enemies and enemy assets all the time, right? And across all different sensor platforms. And it seems like in order to get there, you have to have AI. Like you can't have 1,000 analysts. Even if you have 1,000 analysts, like they can't communicate with each other very effectively. So it seems like you have to have AI in order to do this.
Yeah. A lot of the problems of ISR today, and part of the story we need to tell to our customers using the AI expertise we have, but also get right from learning from them and learning about their problems, is to articulate how, even if the manual methods today are good enough, also how the lack of a tech stack that enables bringing in this AI limits you from this whole world of the possible of much more ambitious things you can do that we actually were thinking about and DARPA was thinking about with like cybernetics in the 70s and 80s. And that work is gonna be long and hard. I think like there's a few problems that stand out with the system today that are holding us back from that. One is there's no standardization. So a lot of these like networks and like planes or boats that are being built and equipped and then connected together today, often by, you know, cost plus DoD service contractors, because everything's cost plus and everything's services and everything's being done once. No one has an incentive to standardize everything. And like the industry hasn't even put a ton of work into standardization. There is some, and it's getting better all the time, but choose an example. One of the mission profiles that our automated targeting AI platform has been focused on is maritime surface targeting. So going on a unmanned surface vessel, like a drone ship, or going on like a reconnaissance vessel, or going on like a destroyer, and just watching the horizon and fusing everything they see from all their sensors, you know, their sonar, their radar, their infrared, to watch ships. And this is especially important in Indo-PACOM. And provide a plug-and-play way to do this for, you know, ships that have already been built decades ago and now need to talk together to see over the horizon, especially when, like, U.S. Navy destroyers have missiles that can shoot farther than they can see with their radar or want to see because they don't want to turn their radars on to be detected. And we were actually doing a test with a DoD customer at a DoD exercise a few weeks ago where we were plugging our AI onto this boat, onto their sensors, and it was a infrared camera. And we had integrated with infrared cameras from this company before. And afterwards, I was talking to the engineering team, and I was like, how'd the exercise go? What'd you guys learn? What problems did you have? And they were like, well, we spent 2 more days than we wanted to on integrations. And I was like, why is that? We've spent a lot of time on modularity. We've seen this problem before. What's up? And they were like, no, like, John, you don't understand. We were talking to a infrared camera that we've integrated with the exact same SKU, the exact same make and model from another time ago. And the exact same SKU had a different video encoding and a different IMU.
That's insane.
And I was like, oh, okay, we got to build like another integration tool to automate that in the future. And yeah, that's an example of a lot of the problems we're working through. But what you get on the other side of that, like when you have the standardization to be plug and play, and once you're plug and play, you're collecting way more data, both modern, but anyone building AI for defense, although modern's going the widest because we only do AI and we integrate with everyone. Once you do that, you get all of these advantages that we're missing today. And like one of those is very simply your data and your insights are easier to share, right? So even when you have a human who, let's assume they're flawless and they're watching these sensors like these infrared cameras and these radars on these boats, they're flawless, they're not missing anything, they immediately classify everything right. Still, if they want to share that, they either need to like get on the phone with someone or get on the radio, you know, and give them a lat long, or they need to like manually like type in coordinates or like fill out a form to send this who, what, when, where off to command or off to like another ship or another plane to take action on it. But when you solve this really simple problem, which is just what we're doing in this tech stack of let's turn sensor data into a data packet that is a who, what, when. Now you can share it. And now you can build other applications on top of that. And that's part of what we're unlocking and part of why this is the place to start.
It's so interesting. Just going back to the naval example, I've spent a lot of time kind of nerding out on World War II and World War II in the Pacific specifically. And like the question on every commander's mind all the time is like, where are the Japanese assets?
Yeah.
Right. Like that was, and there were many battles that were turned because a spotter plane from either side spotted, you know, some naval asset and that triggered a response. And, you know, if you fast forward, like there's a famous fighter pilot named John Boyd who came up with this concept of the OODA loop, right? Observe, orient, decide, and act. And the principle is like in any competition, whether, you know, combat or something else, the faster you can observe, orient, decide, and act, the better your chances of coming out on top. And a big part of that is just exactly what you described, which is ISR. It's just trying to understand, you know, what's in a space, what's in an environment, and where it is and what it's doing.
All right, we got a Boyd reference. This is a defense podcast now. I like it.
This is a defense podcast. Yeah. not to run down a tangent now, but that he was a character. There's a famous story of him like going up to some general. I can't remember who it was. He was like a colonel and like yelling at the general and like poking him in the chest with his like lit cigar. The guy was crazy, but he was one of the best sort of military aviation strategists in history. And then I think the Marines ended up adopting like the OODA loop concept as well.
Yeah, I remember hearing the Marines were like after he passed, and I think he passed like not fully appreciated. But like after he passed or like after he retired, the Marines were some of the first to like really go back to all of his writings and internalize it and start talking about it. But that's exactly right. Like, you know, just like in business, just like in computing relationships, like sometimes speed really is just everything. And that was true in Midway when we had a spotter plane, see the Japanese carriers first, you get to launch all your planes first. That's how you have a, you know, 4-0 KD ratio for carriers at Midway. Yeah. That is still fundamentally true today. And part of what is being unlocked now as we move from this connected but still human and manual ISR stack to a connected but software and data-driven stack is once we are now getting these who, what, where's into actual data packets, now you can start accelerating. That's really when I would say, like, you know, some people have said like the AI arms race has begun. Part of why I think we need to build modern now is it hasn't quite started yet. The AI arms race will start after all this connectivity is built together and after all this sensor and platform standardization is done. And then that day, not too far from now, it'll be like the internet, you know, in 1999 or like 2000 when like you just had exponentially more people getting like the internet in their homes. That's like when the real search engine battle started, right? And like that's when you have the most value from software launching this arms race of faster, 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 more applications, more applications. And that's when you can start taking these data packets and building more things on top of them, like decision aids saying like, okay, I know this bad guy's here. Of all the assets I have, who is the closest with the most weapons, with the highest likelihood of success, to unstrike them, and then like who can do automated intelligence analysis to like condense like my 8-page after action report down to like one for general. All of which have been thought about for a long time, but all of which you need this modularity to like really realize.
It's like, it's totally logical. You have to build the foundation first, right? Are we behind the curve on this compared to China, or is China also sort of sitting in this situation where data streams are kind of siloed and they haven't quite figured it out yet?
It's a really good question. I think it's said in politics quite often that China is way ahead of us on X, way ahead of us on Y. And in some cases, I'm sure they have advantages. Like one is data collection, and like the directedness of their military industrial complex. There's no privacy laws in China, keeping China from building, the Chinese military from building massive, massive, massive data sets. And it's actually part of their culture and part of their engineering culture that they are spying on everything, everywhere, all the time, both domestically and abroad. And that creates a ton of data. So I think it's likely they have a lot of data. It's very centralized. And they clean and train models on it really fast. And that matters a lot. More than that, though, to be honest, I don't know. Chinese internet is not largely translated, hard to get into. I will say quite often when we go looking for data sets or when we go looking for ML white papers and research papers from archive for like a specific, I'll say defense specific problem in ML, we find a lot of Chinese papers. And they're normally not like shockingly good. They're normally like okay. Because I do think it's true the US has the talent advantage. With OpenAI, DeepMind, Google, Meta, and of course all the talent we bring from abroad. That advantage is real, but when we go looking for white papers for defense-specific problems, don't find a lot of American or European researchers with their names on those white papers because they're working on not defense-specific problems in industry.
I mean, regardless of where they are, we should be 10 years ahead. Like, yeah, there's no reason why this shouldn't be a top priority.
Yeah, just from like the amount of talent we have and I think the amount of technical infrastructure we do have. But this is actually also one of my theses why it's important to build the foundational AI defense company that is just focused on this problem of working to build the foundation models for defense. Both because you need it to approach the problems of like integration with like all the modularity you want to tie everything together rather than vertically integrate with hardware, but also because there are just a lot of AI research problems that Google and Meta will never touch. And because the research is so foundational and so good, there's always many, many, many things you can take from them. However, for like the more applied stuff, Google's probably never going to have a research team working on sonar. And they're probably never going to have a research team working on synthetic aperture radar. And they're probably never going to have a research team working on like electronic warfare jamming. And there's a huge talent arbitrage to like saying you're just going to do that and then doing that. And of course, defense being the industry it is, you don't need to believe that foundation AI platform companies have a a moat in general to believe they do in defense. Because sometimes if you want to build a foundation model with a moat, just build it in an industry that builds its own moats through like clearances and accreditations and you know, trust and relationships.
100%. And you know, the DoD, it seems like, is used to buying hardware more than software. And you guys are not selling hardware, you're selling software. Has that been a challenge? Like, has that been a, and Palantir is obviously the counter example here, but has that been sort of an uphill battle to convince them to buy software that's not attached to some hardware product?
It's hard, but all defense is hard. I've learned a lot about the best way to sell software to the DoD. I think we made a lot of mistakes early on about how to present and tell the story of a software product in DoD, test it to get feedback and the user's trust. And I think those are unique problems because software can be hard to understand when you're trying to sell a very sophisticated piece of software to a customer or a user that doesn't come from industry or like has worked with all of the newest like SaaS products or like cloud products every single day. However, if you do those right, I'm actually a contrarian here in that some people say it's like impossible to sell software in defense or like you can't do it. That's not true. Like every prime sells billions of dollars of software to the DoD every year, just software. There are businesses whose names probably no one listening to this podcast knows who do 100 million ARR selling licensed software to the DoD with between like, you know, like 100 and 500 employees. You do need to meet your customer where they are and explain to them, this is exactly what this thing is. This is exactly how you integrate it. This is exactly how I'm going to support it. And this is exactly what it's going to do for you. And you need to explain that in like really clear language, but you should be doing that with any product anyways. I think it is true. The contracts can be harder to negotiate and price because you normally need to like fill out the like, you know, price sheet as if you're selling like widgets. But like selling, you know, Microsoft has been selling software licenses to the DoD for like, you know, 50 years. So like, you can do that.
If you, I mean, you've been selling software to the DoD for the last 4 years. If you were going to go back to day one, given all that you learned, what advice would you have given yourself?
Two big things come to mind. One, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And in defense, there's no win unless you go together. And
you mean like collaborating with other companies?
Both collaborating
with like with a team.
Yeah, I actually also mean with like your DoD partners.
Got it.
So, like the size of a defense contract you win is roughly proportional to like how many stakeholders you need to win over in some office or like set of offices and commands. So you can get a $1 or $2 million CBER with like two users signing a letter of support and then one reviewer putting you at the top of the stack for AFWERX. And you can win some test pilots with OTAs by being right place, right time, right submission with, you know, like 1 to 3 PMs that you maybe meet at some industry days and then like your submission. However, the really big wins that are going to get you ARR and get you across the valley of death, there is no such thing as a quick win there. So I think that piece of advice is don't look for a quick win in defense. Don't constantly be looking for like, you know, who's like the one, where's the one place where you feel like you have a special relationship or a special mission match for your capability, or like there's a special amount of funding, because there's no shortcuts. And the sooner you get started doing the hard work of aligning the 50 people between users, program managers and requirements, and then funding and leaders, to actually get the big wins that matter and will get you in the field, the sooner you can actually win. So one would just be, there's no quick wins, so don't go looking for them. You're just going to waste your time and spin your wheels. I think the second thing is that success and failure in defense can depend a lot on choosing the right customer. You might have the best mission fit, like you might have the best product and mission fit you could ever hope for a customer's problems. But if Congress didn't give them the money, they didn't give them the money. Sure. And they might not tell you that we don't actually have the money. I can't actually tell you when I'm going to have the money. On the other hand, there's other offices that end the year with $50 million too much money, where you might have had a product fit or at least been able to build enough of a relationship they would tell you how to get from where you are today to true product fit with them, and you know, help your development with a little bit of that money. And these two, I realize these two pieces of advice to former John, you know, pick your customers carefully, and to invest in long-term wins rather than looking for short-term wins. They're kind of in tension, because it might take you 18 months or even, you know, 6 months, which is an eternity in startups, to just figure out that one customer doesn't have the money. And so you need to have a lot of advisors and people who know the particular space you're looking at or the particular office you're looking at to give you some color on like what the world of possible is there, or at least get you talking to the users and PMs. You can like tell it to you straight really quickly. And you do need to run really hard on, you know, building the 50 relationships in that whole organization that can give you that picture. But also you want to be like really thoughtful about picking, going for that person when you start. And then you should also be like ready to pivot if it's just not going to happen with them, or at least not going to happen for, you know, 3 years.
That's great advice. And one more hypothetical question. Let's say all of a sudden you're the president of the United States and your top priority is preparing the DOD and the intelligence community to be kind of the leaders in artificial intelligence. Like what's your game plan? What do you focus on?
One, you need to remove profit limitations on DOD contracts. You need to remove the margin limits that DOD contract officers are encouraged to argue for and demand in their contracts, because that's actually how you unlock competition, compensate the best talent in the world to come and work on defense, and eventually get the best value. It is possible, especially in software, that a VC-backed company can build a product in defense that solves a real problem, and you know, sell it to you for $500 million and make 80% profit margin, that is 10x better than a $2 million contract with 20% profit margin that you give to a prime. However, legally, in you know, the DFAR, Defense Federal Acquisition Regulations, and like the GSA pricing schedule, that is really, really, really hard to do. Maybe not legally is the term, but in policy. So one, you need to be comfortable giving the best capability and the best team massive margins, because that's actually how you're going to get the best capability for the best price. And actually let someone hire someone from OpenAI who makes $800,000 a year, but still really, yeah, really wants to have an impact on defending the Western world. Second thing is make getting security clearances way more streamlined. We have been working on that for like a long time. Lots of other companies, you know, it slows them down a lot. And maybe the answer here is just like, we need to fund the DoD offices responsible for evaluating clearances so that they have like 10 times as many people to make those investigations go faster. But it's way too slow today. It's way too slow for companies, and it's way too slow for people. And it's really, really important, actually, that your industry partners in defense who are doing research or building capabilities know what's behind the steel door. I think it is sometimes really underappreciated that really just how good some of the engineers at a lot of the primes are, and some of the engineers in the government are, and for specific problems, how much time and thought and money they put into it. And you might think you've built something that's really hot shit, but there's something that already does that and maybe better that's behind a steel door and you don't know about it. And so like the sooner people can get read into those capabilities, the better contributors they will actually be. And like the more they can help out and understand the problem, which of course is the most important thing in defense, understanding your users. And then the third thing, this is an AI specific, we need a $1 trillion defense top line budget. It's like 850 million today. That's not keeping track with inflation. And that budget is under an immense amount of pressure at the most critical time for America's defense investment in really 4 decades. And it's also at a historical low as a percentage of GDP. If you ever hear anyone claim that the US government is going on some wild defense industry spending spree at the cost of education and healthcare, both of which, of course, are fundamental things we need to invest in and provide, show them a chart of like how the US government's investments in medicine, education, and defense as a percentage of GDP has broken down over the last 4 decades. And, you know, health and education did this, defense did this. And it was okay doing that for a while because we had this supremacy that came from the Reagan defense investments. But that legacy is worn out. DoD personnel salary needs to go up to make, to keep track with inflation, but also solve the recruiting crisis. Sure. And keep the DoD staffed with the best people. At the same time, all these legacy platforms that we have and still rely on, as they get older, the amount of maintenance they require is exploding. And so you're actually crushing the DoD budget right now. It's so historically small at this critical point where we're trying to basically rebuild everything. And it's getting crushed between the needs to raise salaries for DoD personnel, which we need to do, the need to maintain these legacy platforms that we need to do. And we don't want to divest right now, because if we divest them too early and like retire them to free up that maintenance budget, then we'll have a lot less capability for the next 5 years before the new systems come online. And so that there's this crushing that is happening, and every day it gets worse and actually limits the amount of new technology investments we're able to make, especially investments in the defense industrial base, to be able to manufacture things like more subs and chips.
It's great. I'm sold. If people want to follow you or follow the company, where should they go?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I don't tweet a lot. However, I watch the world from Twitter and, you know, share modern news, and hiring needs. I think we're at, I don't even know my Twitter handle. It's just John Doolin. I think it's like John D. Doolin.
Perfect.
Yeah, it's at John D. Doolin. Modern Intelligence AI shares a little bit about our research, our mission, and the platform. We should be getting a blog up there soon to talk more deeply about those things, why they're important, and what we're up to.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining, John.
Will, thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to the Autopilot Podcast. If you're using AI to create or disrupt a large industry, I would love to learn more about your story. Drop me a line on Twitter or go to our website, apv.vc. If you want to support the show, the best ways are to leave a review wherever you're listening and subscribe. The Autopilot Podcast is part of Turpentine, the podcast network behind Moment of Zen, Turpentine VC, Age of Miracles, and more shows for experts by experts in tech.